I had a rather startling revelation quite recently when I saw a statement where officials of the Seventh-day Adventist Church declared openly that major doctrinal change has occurred, and such change has occurred in order to correct error that was held and taught by our pioneers. I don't know about you, but this struck me as being very significant. And some of the statements, at least there were two statements that I saw which brought that across to me. The first is one written by George Knight, Andrews University Seminary professor, and this statement was recorded in the Ministry Magazine. Of course, the Ministry Magazine is an official publication of the Seventh-day Adventist Church for the clergy or the pastors. The statement went like this: most of the founders of Seventh-day Adventism would not be able to join the church today if they had to subscribe to the denomination's fundamental beliefs. More specifically, most would not be able to agree to belief number two, which deals with the doctrine of the Trinity. And this is taken from Ministry Magazine of October 1993 on page 10. Needless to say, this was very startling to me. For the first time, something of this sort was being brought to my attention, because all along, I just took it for granted that the doctrinal framework of the Seventh-day Adventist Church has come down to us over time, over years, from the pioneers. George Knight, in his article, went on to list the names of such individuals as Joseph Bates, James White, M.E. Cornell, J.N. Andrews, E.J. Wagoner, and Uriah Smith as being among such founding ones who could not be members of the church today if they were to subscribe to the denomination's fundamental beliefs. There's another article I saw which was published in the Adventist Review, January 6, 1994. And this one was written by none other than the editor of the Adventist Review, William Johnson, where he said, "Some Adventists today think that our beliefs have remained unchanged over the years, or they seek to turn back the clock to some point when we had everything just right." Perhaps he was well describing persons like myself. I continue. "But all attempts to recover such historic Adventism fail in view of the facts of our heritage. Adventist beliefs have changed over the years under the impact of present truth. Most startling is the teaching regarding Jesus Christ, our Savior and Lord. Many of the pioneers, including J.H. Wagoner, held to an Arian or semi-Arian view." Well, he lists J.H. Wagoner, James White, J.N. Andrews, and Uriah Smith. I continue. "The Trinitarian understanding of God, no part of our fundamental beliefs, was not generally held by the early Adventists." Here we have statements by two respected and eminent officials within the Seventh-day Adventist Church, boldly stating that major doctrinal change has taken place, specifically with respect to the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, some investigation on my part revealed that those names listed were not the only ones. When George Knight said most of the founders, he was not wrong, because there were others such as A.T. Jones, R.F. Cottrell, John Mattison, D.W. Hull, M.C. Wilcox, G.W. Amadon, J.N. Loughborough, and a number of others. Most of the pioneers were not only non-Trinitarian, but were anti-Trinitarian. Now, this came as a shock to me, to say the very least, because the Trinity doctrine is one of those things that, over time, I've just taken for granted. Because everybody basically believes it, except for Jehovah's Witnesses. And it was one of those things that I just took as given. And I dare to say that this view on my part, I don't think it was unique. Because even at this point, mentioning to professed Seventh-day Adventists that the pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventist movement were non-Trinitarian is something that seems a bit strange to them, because many Seventh-day Adventists have taken it for granted that a doctrine like the Trinity is one that is basically set, and persons do not question doctrines, well, at least that particular doctrine. Well, as we shall see shortly from articles that were written by the Seventh-day Adventist pioneers, they were not only non-Trinitarian, but they were anti-Trinitarian. They wrote extensively against this doctrine, and we are going to see exactly why in a little while. But even then, in terms of an evolution of thought, the fact that the church now professes something which was almost universally rejected by the pioneers, though that was a shock to me, but it was an even greater shock to me when I discovered the origin of that doctrine which is now held by the church, which was rejected by our pioneers. Would you believe that the Trinity doctrine was actually formulated by the Roman Catholic Church? Well, this was certainly startling to me. If I never thought of it before, I would certainly have to investigate the matter now. I would certainly have to investigate it. Because when you think of the implications of such a fact that the pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventist Church were holding a doctrine or rejecting a doctrine which the church has subsequently had to take from the Roman Catholic Church, then it raises very serious questions as to whether or not the church was really founded on a prophetic basis, if the church is correct in departing from what the pioneers held. The implications are very significant. So what I'm saying is that it is not a simple thing to just brush aside the pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and say, well, I suppose they were just in error. And then, not only that, when you look on the other side of the coin, the Roman Catholic Church, the ones who would at that time, when supposedly the pioneers were teaching error, had the truth, what does the scripture have to say about them? In Revelation 7:8, we read of the little horn power, which based on the specifications we have identified as the papacy, the Roman Catholic Church, which would think to change times and laws and would wear out the saints of the Most High and would tread the truth underfoot. That is also significant. And according to what the church is now saying, that those who tread the truth underfoot, those who were, we understand, were led by God, had to go to them for what? For truth. That would be the implication. In 2 Thessalonians 2, mention is made of the mystery of iniquity, which based on the specifications again, we understand to represent the Roman Catholic Church. Revelation 7 and 17 and 18 also speaks of Mr. Babylon the Great, which prophetically we understand to represent the Roman Catholic Church again, which the Bible tells us drunkens all the nations with its wine of false doctrine, and also trades or makes merchandise of the souls of men, Revelation 18:3, and in whom was found the blood of prophets, saints, and of all them that were slain upon the earth. Now, it is not a simple thing to simply dismiss the pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and say that, well, okay, they must have just been in error. And, you know, some time ago I brought the matter to the attention of someone whose response was simply that, well, you know, not because we might have our enemies, it means that they are always wrong. And, you know, I said, but this is not a personal thing. This is not a personal thing about personal enemies. On a human level, when we have supposed enemies, quote unquote, we cannot therefore determine that, okay, because we do not agree, then they are wrong on everything. In this case, this is a spiritual matter where we are talking about those who are chosen by God, as we understand it, as opposed to those who are teaching doctrines which the Bible describes in very strong terms, the mystery of iniquity, doctrines of devils. We're talking about light as opposed to darkness, those who are supposed to be the light bearers as opposed to those who are seeking to tread the truth underfoot, and those who drunk the nations with wine, a false doctrine. This is not a personal matter. It's a very serious indictment that we would therefore be making against the pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventist movement, because we would therefore be saying that while they were denouncing the other churches of Christendom which did not accept the message that was proclaimed in the first angel's message in the Advent movement under William Miller, while they were denouncing them as constituting Babylon, we would be saying that those churches had the truth about God, while these pioneers denouncing them as Babylon were themselves teaching false doctrine. Then wouldn't we be saying that the pioneers would be perhaps more reasonable to be classified as Babylon? Many persons say today the Seventh-day Adventist Church holds the official position that the pioneers came from diverse backgrounds, and because of that they came along with a lot of baggage, so to speak, a lot of unclear ideas. But that is not true, because when you look at the history of those persons who are the pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventist movement, many of them came from the very same churches which were Trinitarian churches. So what? They had the truth while they were out there, and then in coming to what we would recognize as God's prophetically appointed movement, they dropped the truth to come and start teach some error, only for a later generation to come and reverse it. What a serious indictment against those who were led by God to the point where the prophetic gift was manifested among them. It's not a simple matter. And going even further, it would be a serious indictment against the prophet of God who was among them too. Because repeatedly, Sister White has spoken of the firm platform of truth to which God had progressively led the pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventist movement. A matter of fact, let me just share with you one such statement that is made in the book Early Writings, which I find very significant. Early Writings, page 2:59, the prophet says of the pioneers, God had led them along step by step until he had placed them upon a solid, immovable platform. Think about that. Also, in another statement in Selected Messages, Book 1, page 204, she refers to the doctrinal platform that was embraced by the early pioneers as having been built by the master worker, by God himself. When error sought to intrude among the early believers through one of the great luminaries among them, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, the fear of pantheism, the prophet of God met the crisis head on, as was her custom to do when it came on to meeting error and helping to keep error out of the church. And that is one of the roles of the prophet. In addressing the situation with John Harvey Kellogg when he sought to bring in the doctrine of pantheism, she said these words, and I'm quoting from Selected Messages, Book 1, page 204. In a vision of the night, I was shown distinctly that these sentiments those that were trying to be brought in by Kellogg have been looked upon by some as the grand truths that are to be brought in and made prominent at the present time. I was shown a platform braced by solid timbers, the truths of the Word of God. Someone high in responsibility in the medical work was directing this man and that man to loosen the timbers supporting this platform. Then I heard a voice saying, "Where are the watchmen that ought to be standing on the walls of Zion? Are they asleep? This foundation was built by the master worker and will stand storm and tempest. Will they permit this man to present doctrines that deny the past experience of the people of God? The time has come to take decided action." So what I'm saying, in refuting that error, the prophet made it very clear that the doctrinal framework was built by the master worker and would stand the storm and the tempest. And the question was asked, would the people of God sit by and allow doctrines to be presented that deny the past experience of the people of God? And I would ask the same question today. Can we sit back and allow doctrines to be promulgated which deny the past experience of the people of God? Because the point is, if we are to accept that the pioneers were wrong on such a fundamental point as the nature of the God whom we worship, and they had to go to the mystery of iniquity, to those whom the scriptures identify as it were the custodians of error, those from whom error is continuously being disseminated to the world, they have to go to them for truth, then what are we saying about the history of this movement? Then there would be no validity to it. Could there be? Certainly not. Well, will we deny our past history? We cannot afford to. If we take the warnings that were given by the prophet of God with respect to efforts that would be made in future from her day, to change the doctrinal framework of the church, then we would perhaps better understand the moves that have taken place over time. You know, I like us to look back at what Sister White called the alpha of deadly heresies, which is a term she used to to refer to that case when John Harvey Kellogg sought to bring in confusing ideas about God. She referred to this as the alpha of deadly heresies. This doctrine of pantheism, you will recognize, well, you might be aware, had to do with the nature of God. How was God to be viewed? John Harvey Kellogg was bringing in an idea which totally removes the concept of God being the sovereign of the universe, one person as the sovereign of the universe, but rather picturing God as more like an essence that pervades all nature. Now, Sister White had much to say about this alpha of deadly heresies, and in correcting much of what was contained in this alpha of deadly heresies, she made a very significant prediction that the Omega would follow. Now, I wanted to think about this seriously. When a thing is presented as the alpha, the alpha is the first letter of the Greek alphabet and Omega the last. So we generally think of alpha and Omega as first and last. And of course, not being unrelated, the alpha being of one sort, we would hardly expect the Omega to be much different. But listen to what Sister White said, and I'm quoting from Selected Messages, Volume 1, page 197. We have now before us the alpha of this danger. The Omega will be of a most startling nature. It will be of a most startling nature. But nonetheless, it's the Omega. It's like something complementary to what came about originally through John Harvey Kellogg. But the Omega would be of a more startling nature. The Alpha had to do with the nature of God. How we view God. She writes again, page 200 of the same book. In the book Living Temple, that's the book that Kellogg wrote, advancing his pantheistic theories, there is presented the alpha of deadly heresies. The Omega will follow. And listen to this. And will be received by those who are not willing to heed the warning God has given. So she predicted that when the Omega should come, which would be of a more startling nature, it would be received. She writes again, page 203. Living Temple contains the alpha of these theories. I knew that the Omega would follow in a little while. Look at that, in a little while. And I trembled for our people. You know, it is very significant. She said the Alpha was being experienced then, the Omega. Not only is it that it would soon come, but it would be received. It would be received, and it would be of a most startling nature. The spiritualistic theories regarding the personality of God, followed to their logical conclusion, sweep away the whole Christian economy. Page 204. Now, in considering these things, I want us to consider what has taken place over time, and we are going to look at the history of how the change was brought about from the non-Trinitarian position that was held by the pioneers to the point where the church now officially professes itself to be a Trinitarian church. And I want you to judge for yourself whether such a thing as the Omega of deadly heresies has crept in among us. Now, one of the things that she said in speaking of this Omega is that in the acceptance of it, the fundamental principles which had sustained the work She said over the last 50 years, and she wrote this in about 1904, or prior to the year 1904 she wrote this, she said they would be accounted as error. Listen to the statement. Selected Messages, Volume 2. It's from pages 204 to 205. She says, the enemy of souls has sought to bring in the supposition that a great reformatory movement, a great reformation, was to take place among Seventh-day Adventists, and that this reformation would consist in giving up the doctrines which stand as the pillars of our faith and engaging in a process of reorganization. Were this reformation to take place, what would be the result? Listen carefully. The principles of truth that God in his wisdom has given to the remnant church would be discarded. Think about that. Our religion would be changed. The fundamental principles that have sustained the work for the last 50 years would be accounted as error. A new organization would be established. Books of a new order would be written. A system of intellectual philosophy would be introduced. The founders of this system would go into the cities and do a wonderful work. The Sabbath, of course, would be lightly regarded, as also the God who created it. Nothing would be allowed to stand in the way of the new movement. The leaders would teach that virtue is better than vice. But God being removed, they would place their dependence on human power, which, without God, is worthless. Their foundation would be built on the sand, and storm and tempest would sweep away the structure. Now, I have been investigating and looking at the beliefs that were held officially by the Seventh-day Adventist Church for 50 years prior to 1904, around which time this statement was made. And I cannot find one doctrine which has been officially discarded and accounted as error, except this concept about God. Now, there are persons who teach and advocate certain points which are not consistent with historic faith, but in terms of official recognition in the church and official advocacy as doctrine, think about it. The Trinity doctrine is perhaps the only doctrine